Mr. Cochrane, Rail 21. We'd got to the point where you'd gone to the mountain warfare school and the unit had concentrated and you were all meeting each other again. What was the mess life like? Because it's very rare you were in a mess, a regiment.
No, we still didn't have... It was a tent, if you like, under canvas. And we didn't have... We still lived with our companies, which suited me fine. By this time, I had had a replacement for the second in command who'd been wounded and then died of his wounds at the casino. The chap called Bobby Burns, who had been the in charge of the pioneer platoon, i.e. doing all the mine lifting, he came as my second in command, and I had a couple of new company officers. Both turned out to be very good. Again, this was a good time to sort of get them fitted in. Also, I had one officer who'd been with me ever since Shetland, Robin Collier, who was a regular soldier. I mean, the army was to be his career. Although he hadn't had any service before the war, he was too young, and he was an excellent platoon commander. So we set off after our mountain warfare, going up the, if you like, the middle of Italy.
Hang on, just a bit. What sort of course did you have in mountain warfare? What were they teaching you? Can you
really
remember?
Really, it was it was a good old thing about physical fitness. We went sort of climbing up steep hills, carrying hot things we had, doing sort of minor ops on the top, practicing again liaison between companies and battalion HQ. I think it was... I don't think we ever actually, in our fighting all through Tuscany, used any of the particularly mountainous or mountaineering skills that we were supposed to have. However, Tuscany has got lots of little hills in it, and the question of getting up and down the hills, getting round them, keeping communications going, that was certainly useful.
Now, what was the situation in Tuscany? This is the central strip, right?
Yes.
Hilly area, but...
Yes, hilly area.
Not mountainous, though, obviously.
Very few, the roads were few, still are, running up the middle of Italy. The most roads in Italy, certainly in that part, either they run up the east coast or the west coast, and there are pretty few connecting roads running across the spine. And again... Ideally built for defensive positions, not built, but created for defensive positions.
Now, when did the operation start that you were involved in there? Do you know what month they kicked off?
I couldn't say without looking it up. It must have been, I should think, probably the end of June, beginning of July. By which time, I mean, it was getting really hot now. We were in, we were out of battle dress, or we'd been out of battle dress for some time, and back in drill. Also, of course, it was the official malaria season had opened in May, so we were all issued with, I think it was a thing called Mepocrine, little yellowish tablets, which you were supposed to take one a day or two a day. I've forgotten about this. And the jocks were, as always with these things, they were convinced that this really was so-called, they say this is to keep malaria away, but in fact it's to damp down our sexual urges and keep us on the straight and narrow when we go on leave.
Now, what was the sort of fighting like? That you were liaising with partisans and things like that.
Well, we had, yes, we had partisans. I think after the war, rather like as in France, everybody you met had been in the resistance. And after the war, umpteen people claimed to have been partigiani in Italy. But in Tuscany, it's, and I think probably further north as well, this was true. And they were very helpful because they, you know, they in their patch, they knew every nook and corner and how to get round things and how to the back tracks and the back ways. And certainly we had for quite a long time a splendid youth called Aldo, who was a very brave young man and amused us all by, before going off. See, they, for instance, we were talking about patrols earlier. They were absolutely invaluable when you were sending out a patrol, knowing the ground inside out. He was very brave going out on patrol, but a smile to us, we always laughed because, no, he wouldn't wear a tin hat. But he always put a hairnet on before before going into danger. And he jolly well did go into danger, too. Well, this, the fighting took this shape of capturing a place if the Germans were still in it, occupying it if they'd pulled out, standing up to the bombardment that followed. We came across two places where, in fact, we were arrived quicker than the Germans wanted us to, and that led to rather a disastrous affair. A longish ridge, and one of our A company was sent to capture this ridge, which they did with a tiny village, a hamlet, a few scattered farmhouses, so up on the crest on the top. But there was a very fierce counterattack in which most of A company were either made casualties or taken prisoner. And we were, Charlie Company was ordered to counterattack, and which we did the following night. With Robin Collier in command of one of the platoons, and they did well. I mean, they got right in amongst the enemy positions. But the shelling of the ground leading up to the top was intense. We couldn't, there's no way we could have held the position. In fact, capturing the first lot of outposts, German outposts, was no good. I knew that this was not going to work. So I got, I called Robin and his platoon back. The other platoon had got part of the way, the other attacking platoon, but had got pinned down. And I thought it was better not to go in for heroics, but to call it off and pull them back. We had enough casualties as it was.
Now, was this Monte Grillo range, which is above Ribiano?
Yes, yes. And eventually, we began, if you like, with a company attack. It ended up with a whole battalion attack. And eventually it was captured by the entire brigade. The Germans really held that with great tenacity. And then after after that episode, which left a bad taste in the mouth because we weren't used to failing, we were in a little place called Bibiano, a village of some on a not on a mountain top, but on a hill, but with bigger hills beyond it. Now this was shelled at sort of pretty regular intervals. Moggs Hill, the great communicator, came up to see us there. He wanted to tell me exactly what had happened about this A Company attack, which had gone wrong. And B, he wanted to talk to Robin Collier and congratulate him and his platoon on having the partial success of the counterattack. Robin Collier got an MC for his acts there. And he was sitting with me with his tactical staff, which meant, in fact, his FO, the gunner officer, and the second in command of our the division's reconnaissance unit, which was the Central India Horse. Obviously, of course, they were in armoured cars at this time, not in on horses. When one of these, the shells normally landed in the little square of this town or village, big village. But this lot of shells actually hit the building we were in. And my Moggs was sitting with me, and my signaler was the other that he set beside me. And one on either side, and his staff officer, his two staff people were, I suppose, sitting 5 or 6 feet away. And he was on the point of going back again in his Jeep, which was out in the yard, back to Battalion HQ. Well, this burst of shells, it killed the signaler outright. Moggs Hill, when the dust cleared, because of the dust created by the shells, the two that landed in the building was enormous. When that began to clear, I could see Moggs, desperately badly wounded, lying on his back. We got him out. He was still could still speak. And he said, I'm finished, or something like that. Oh, they've got me this time. Yes, I'm finished, Peter, I think is what he said. He had a great hole in his chest and his head were a terrible mess. We got him the Jeep was outside the building, was untouched, and it had, like all Jeeps did, there's a sort of apparatus screwed on top where you could put a stretcher on. We got him on this stretcher and got him down to the regimental aid post, and he died there very shortly after he got back. And that was really a cruel loss. The entire battalion felt it, because he'd made his mark with everybody. So that was a very bitter time. And as always, of course, the second in command, Jamie Thompson, who had been Liverpool Scottish before coming to the Camerons, he took over command. And just exactly as had been the case with Gordon Munro at Casino, took over command with great success.
What was he like, Thompson?
I would say he's a reserved man. Didn't so wear his heart on his sleeve. He knew his business inside out, which is the first thing you want of a commanding officer. And of course, he'd been, as Gordon Munro had been, with the battalion for a considerable time. So he was not any well known, but he knew everybody. It wasn't any, he didn't have to take over. He wasn't a newcomer at all. And of course, you couldn't pause and reflect. We did have, we were pulled out of the line for 2 or 3 days. And so we did have a proper funeral service for Mogg Hill, which helped a great deal. He wasn't just shuffled off in, well, there weren't such things as body bags in those days. And he wasn't just buried with one or two people there. We could all, the battalion in effect, could be present.
Was it done with a degree of ceremony? Could you?
Oh yes, I mean we had we did it properly. We could, in as much as we had the of course the padre took the service, the bugler played the last post, we had, I've forgotten, I think just one piper. We still had our pipers, the various places we, out of the line, we used to put a show on for the inhabitants of the, as it, we had done at Castel Frentano. The pipes and drums would parade. And we had I think the piper played the Flowers of the Forest. And it was a very, very moving occasion, and it was because of that it was good. I felt it very keenly because, it, as I say, he'd been killed sort of sitting next to me, and if he hadn't come up to communicate, he would still have been with us.
Now you became second in command for Thompson.
Yes.
could you tell us what was your role as second in command, would you say?
Well, really, you were in charge of what was called the B echelon. This was the vehicles and people who were not necessary for the actual fighting. But it included the, if you like, what you might call the admin staff of the battalion office, to give it a grand name. And you were in charge of the Q side, quartermaster side, and it meant liaising with brigade, boots, 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 you're continually wanting more boots, you got all the ammunition you wanted and needed, you had to organise the
Now, hang on, how did you get more boots, more ammunition? Do you see what I mean? Yeah. I mean, you were at the peak of your battalion there, yeah, but who did you ask? And how
well, first of all, the brigade DAG, the sort of the chap who was the equivalent of brigade of the quartermastering side, supplies and rations. And, of course, brigade didn't carry a lot of this stuff around. It had to go back to division, divisional stores. Equally, brigade didn't carry around great supplies of ammo and tea and bully beef and so on. So a lot of this came from division. The other thing, of course, which was crucially important, where you could get, where was the petrol supply? So when you were advancing, as we were, this had to move up every, say, 2 or 3 days. So after the 3 days, the line was pretty long. The line of communication. And the roads were mountain tracks, really, hairpin bends up and down. And so these 3-ton lorries used to lumber up, but I thought, going the other way like Hannibal and his elephants, although they were coming south and we were going north. Then you had to get the stuff. There was a kind of, if you like, brigade dropping point for all these things, and then the different battalions of the brigade had to send back from to get their stuff from this, and That in turn had to be got by three-ton lorries up to, well, it depended. Sometimes you could get it forward to the company in a three-ton lorry. Very often, there's no way the lorry could do it. So you had to use 1,500-weight trucks. And clearly, you only could take out what was absolutely essential. The queue side, it took a lot of organizing, and I sort of took my hat off to the chaps who did it, because I can't ever remember really going short of something that was critical.
Who did you deal with in the battalion? Would you deal closely with the quartermaster,
yes,
regimental quartermaster sergeant,
yes,
or battalion?
Yes, he, it was his. Once, I mean, he.
Do you remember who it was, the RQMS? Doesn't matter.
No, I can't. I remember the RSM, a chap called. Well, he always. I still remember his nickname, Greetin' Jimmy. Why, I don't know. I never saw him greeting, what he ever had to greet about, I don't know. He was killed in a bombardment, and my admirable CSM Owens, who'd been in C Company since I got him from the carrier platoon in the Shetlands, he very rightly was made by Jamie Thompson, promoted to be RSM, replaced by one of the platoon sergeants, who again proved excellent as a CSM, Sergeant White, who had been a minor, and he had broken all the rules about being forbidden to enlist, stay in the mines. He'd enlisted as a minor, and like any minor I ever came across in the war, absolutely first-class soldier. And was a very, very good CSM.
How did you actually deal with the RQMS? I mean, what was the nature of it?
This was his pigeon. Once I sort of, obviously, it was he told me what he needed. And once I jumped up and down back at the brigade to say what we needed and insisted that we had to have it and so on, it was really his job, although I was there in the background if necessary, to get the stuff to the companies, the company quartermaster sergeant, CQMS, he was the immediate person. I mean, he dealt with when it happened, things like company pay and so on.
It sounds like the RQMS, they did not the work so much, but they did the detail work, and then you used your rank to make sure that they got it from brigade.
Yeah, that's right, yes, yes. Because in fact, what the list of requirements and then the distribution of what we got was entirely done by the RQMS and his quartermaster sergeants in the companies. But I was there if he needed an umpire, if you like, and also there to, as you say, jump up and down and make sure that we did get it.
Now, what was your sort of day-to-day work?
Well, there was that side of it. That was the main part of it, I think. The second part was the admin rather than the queue side. Were things going okay with the intelligence officer and his intelligence section? What about the MT platoon, the drivers? And there was a company commander in charge of what was called HQ company, but in fact, since the different platoons, the Mortar platoon, the Pioneer platoon, and so on, the intelligence section it was called, they all had an officer in charge. the HQ company officer really could be doubled up with that of second in command, and very often was. So, however, I was glad when we got a new CO, and I could go back again to C Company.
Now, were you again upset when Thompson lost, wasn't confirmed?
Less so, I think, than I was being, than I had been when Gordon Munro was superseded. But in fact, it turned out, I think, a pity that he was superseded, Jemmy Thompson, because once again, we weren't very lucky in our new CEO.
Who was the new one?
Well, a chap called Alistair Noble, whose elder brother had been adjutant in the old 2nd Battalion in 1940 when I joined them. And he had, he was a regular soldier. He'd been an effective company commander, and I'm not sure whether it had been in action or not. And he was a nice chap.
What was wrong with him, though? I mean, there is definitely a sub-element.
Yes. Difficult to put my finger on it quite. He went on being CO right until the end of the war in Europe, I think. But he was very difficult to put one's finger on it. It may just have been me. I probably was too big for my boots, or rather I felt that a proprietorial interest in Charlie Company, my company, and I thought I knew best what was right for the company, both as a group of people and as a fighting unit. Well, I don't think that Alistair was any way contravened all this. I think he got, I think perhaps because he was new, felt, you know, gosh, I'm a new broom, I've got to do some sweeping, where can I sweep? And really, there wasn't, Moggs Hill had produced a damn good battalion, and nothing had gone wrong with it at all under Jamie Thompson. So there really wasn't much to sweep, if anything. But he, I say it may just have been me, not the others. Anyhow, I wasn't comfortable with him.
But
he wasn't comfortable with me.
But he wasn't a failure like, you know, the first
No, absolutely not. No.